This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's no telling which candidates will be left standing after the 2016 presidential primary season. We do know that there won't be so many, and that by the time Republicans and Democrats convene next July, their respective candidates will have been chosen. It didn't always work that way. Party conventions used to be consequential, with candidates decided there. Backroom deals were made. There was real drama on the convention floor and genuine surprises on stage. Back in 1968, Democrats heading to Chicago were divided. That year, ABC ranked third out of three networks and did the unthinkable. Instead of providing wall-to-wall coverage like CBS and NBC, they hired two political commentators to debate the day's events, the conservative William F. Buckley and the liberal Gore Vidal. Our next guest says that television commentary has gone downhill ever since. Robert Gordon is producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of the new documentary Best of Enemies, which tells the story of the Buckley-Vidal debates, an adapted introduction to his forthcoming book, Buckley versus Vidal, the historic 1968 ABC News debates, appeared in Politico. Robert Gordon, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. Thanks for having me on and up in New Hampshire.
Well, you know, it's such an interesting story, and this was kind of a wild stab for ABC. What was behind this, as they called it, unconventional convention coverage?
Well, for ABC, they were third out of three networks. They would have been fourth, but there were only three. They were that far behind the other two. And this was really economically driven for them. They needed the income from their primetime shows like The Flying Nun and Batman and those kind of things, Land of the Giants. So they didn't want to go gavel to gavel like had become the journalistic standard. And many news outlets made fun of them for forsaking their journalistic integrity. Part of the way they were going to make up for this lack of in-depth coverage was getting commentators on at night to give commentary on what had happened during the day at the Republican and Democratic national conventions. They approached William Buckley, who was the leading light in reforming the conservative movement at the time, and asked him to participate. And this was going to be the biggest audience he would have had yet on national TV. So he accepted, and they said, "Who do you want to debate?" And he named a number of his liberal friends, probably including Norman Mailer. And they said, "Who do you not want to debate?" And his very interesting reply was, "Well, on principle, I wouldn't debate a communist. And other than that, the only one I can think of is Gore Vidal." And I strongly suspect that ABC's next call was to Gore Vidal.
So they knew they were setting up a fight.
They thought they were going to get some friction. What they didn't realize was that they would get the whole explosion of the culture wars that we live in today, you know, neatly packaged in these two guys going head to head.
And you said Buckley was somewhat motivated anyway by trying to rebrand conservatives. He was trying to distance them from, what did he call them, the kooks and anti-Semites. What was behind it for Vidal? Why did he participate?
Well, Vidal had a policy of never saying no to sex or appearing on television. So that's part of what motivated him. And, you know, he had run for political office on the Kennedy ticket in 1960. He considered himself, you know, potentially presidential material, which was something I came to understand in the making of this film and was really shocking to me to realize. But Vidal was a very progressive thinker and also recognized the opportunity of this national audience. And it's important to keep in mind that in 1968, the audience was not predetermined. In other words, Fox now preaches to the Fox audience. MSNBC preaches to the MSNBC audience. Each preaches to its choir. When we were a nation of only three networks, you could change people's minds. So these guys were seizing the opportunity to help recruit people to their way of thinking.
Well, in 1968, Chicago was also remembered for a very different clash. Mayor Daley, Chicago police and National Guard cracking down very hard on protesters. Even Dan Rather, Mike Wallace, other reporters were roughed up while at the convention. How did that play out in these nightly recaps with Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley?
Well, they did Miami first, and it was actually Miami Beach. Gore, when he gets to Chicago, he called it a sandbar with a drawbridge. So it had been this very distant, controlled place, even though there was a riot in Miami Beach, which we found footage of. You know, at that time, the Democratic Party was the party of war. The Vietnam War was their war. And protesters were descending there to say, you know, get us out of Vietnam. We're not going to fight this war. Johnson was not going to run. It had gotten more than chaos to the point where it was practically civil war. There was actual, you know, legitimate discussion of anticipating a civil war in the U.S. over Vietnam. And that August in 68 in Chicago is probably the nearest we came. And Buckley and Vidal, by the time of Chicago, are really reflecting the tensions in the Chicago street and in the country. They both embody the polarized positions.
We're speaking with Robert Gordon. He is a producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of a new documentary. It's called Best of Enemies, which tells the story of these debates and distinguishes them from the bombastic political debates on television of today. Well, let's hear just a little bit of the penultimate debate between the two. This is where things got heated.
As far as I'm concerned, the only pro-crypto-Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that, I would only say that we can't have the right of assembly. Let's stop calling names.
And you'll stay plastered.
Gentlemen, let's...
Okay, there they go. In their very patrician accents, I might add, calling each other crypto-Nazi and queer. Not really civil political discourse, but what was it?
Well, when we were beginning this film, one of the questions we kept asking ourselves was, you know, when did civil discourse become uncivil? And in essence, we knew this film was about these two guys, William F. Buckley Jr. and Gore Vidal. And the research led us to understand that it was also about ABC and about networks and about ratings, because these guys were given 15 minutes uninterrupted each night of the conventions for their contretemps. And it's a much slower burn than we're accustomed to now. And people tuned in because this was a fight that built. You know, ABC was surprised that it was a success. They were trying to steer these guys back onto the subject at hand. But for these two men, the subject was each other. And over time, what has happened is that networks took away the notion of shouting sells. You know, shouting gets ratings. And we live in a world now where commercials are punctuated by 4 minutes of shouting. That's political discourse on TV as we know it. And I think it can be traced to that incident, and the build is forgotten. The build is where the content was, and the content has been forgotten, and all we have is the shouting.
Well, we had two public intellectuals duking it out on television, and your lament is that it is not something that we're likely to see today, despite having hundreds of channels of content. But why not? I mean, there are plenty of pundits debating issues of the moment on television.
Well, I don't know. I tune in and hear talking points from party shills. Sometimes I hear pundits. Sometimes there are a few environments left, but not many. We don't hear it in the public discourse the way we used to on, say, Dick Cavett or even Johnny Carson in a way. These shows weren't advertisements for the newest release of whatever. And I have a little hope, you know, that with all these channels, some network that's just like all the other networks will be failing and say, wow, we can't attract the audience everyone else is attracting. What audience out there is underserved? And that perhaps someone would say, what if we try to create an environment that recruits what we used to call the public intellectual, someone now in a university or a think tank who is engaging to the public. That's what we forget, the humor of the public intellectual, who's not a party shill. We finished this film in January of this year, and we've had it on the road at film festivals for, you know, 8 or so months. And I can say, based on my encounter with now thousands of people, that Americans are hungry for nuance and are hungry for actual content. You know, networks are afraid to break the mold. That one, I hope, will finally take the chance and we will be able to see original thought return to television.
Well, Robert Gordon, a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you. And I can't wait to see the film.
Thanks for having me on.
Robert Gordon, he's producer and director, along with Morgan Neville, of the new documentary Best of Enemies, which tells the story of the Buckley-Vidal debates, an adapted introduction to his forthcoming book, Buckley versus Vidal, the historic 1968 ABC News debates, appeared in Politico. You'll find a link to read it for yourself and more on the documentary and the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we just heard from Robert Gordon, ABC's unconventional coverage of the 1968 political conventions turned television debates into a blood sport. The showdown between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley, a pair of public intellectuals who loathed each other, was a huge hit, and the more established networks took notice. CBS added Point Counterpoint to its venerable 60-minute show in the 1970s, pitting liberal author Shayna Alexander against the conservative columnist James Jack Kirkpatrick.
At home, the holly is plastic, the turkey is cardboard. Most American food is disgusting, most American people are overweight. The rest of the world is starving, and nobody gives a damn. If you're not appalled, Jack, I am.
We've both flown many times, Shayna, coast to coast, but we see a different land below. You see the bad aspects of American society. They're there. As a critic, I write about these aspects all the time, and I don't mean to minimize them. But there's so much more.
Both commentators presented prepared, civil remarks, which aired back to back. But they didn't engage directly, as Jane Curtin and Dan Aykroyd did in Saturday Night Live's memorable point-counterpoint parody.
Dan, there's an old saying. Behind every successful man, there's a woman, a loving, giving, caring woman. But you wouldn't know about that, Dan, because there's no old saying about what's behind a miserable failure.
Jane, you ignorant slut.
And they were off. The split-screen smackdowns were soon to follow and had their heyday when 24-hour cable news came on the scene. With hours to fill and talk radio grabbing market share, ideological bickering made for inexpensive TV programming and even cheaper thrills. Programs like Crossfire, Hardball, and The O'Reilly Factor turned up the volume, with partisan guests almost guaranteed to rile viewers up with sheer shoutfest.
Liberal Democrats, this is a predictive disaster.
Let me just point out one example.
That's not a perversion of reality, Newt. Those are facts.
For the Republican Party.
No, for
he's done everything that he can. He needs help from Republicans to solve this.
Okay.
Where's the outrage? Well, it was spreading like wildfire across the dry ground of cable, into ginned-up brawls on Geraldo and Jerry Springer, and the manufactured slap fights on reality TV. Jon Stewart, now former host of The Daily Show, was a vocal critic of cable news theatrics, a point he made in a genuine debate with Crossfire host Tucker Carlson when Stewart was a guest on the show in 2004.
You're doing theater.
when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
You do it's not honest.
What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you why I know.
You have John Kerry on your show, and you sniff his throne, and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding me.
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls.
The debate is an essential part of the democratic process, especially in a country deeply divided along political lines. Families and neighbors may avoid touchy subjects and steer clear of conflict in person, but they get to see it all acted out on TV. All that snark and posturing is easy to parrot and has made its way into how many citizens now communicate opinions. All rage and no dialogue. But when insults designed for soundbites, retweets, or going viral are the prevailing model, what gets lost? The issues. As our guest Robert Gordon wrote recently in New York Magazine, TV debates have become a professional wrestling match where success is judged by how angry or excited the audience becomes. Where Buckley and Vidal were a forest fire fueled by acres of old wood, today we surf channels between pieces of flash paper exploding. Big flames, no content. William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal were not polite debaters, but they were brilliant and witty and brought real intellectual rigor to their opinions and were given enough time to hash them out. And yes, that did make them vicious and great fun to watch. As home to the first in the nation primary, New Hampshire plays host to candidates sometimes years before elections. With all those accumulated stump speeches in TV and internet ads, voters are at risk of suffering campaign fatigue long before aspiring politicians even touch down in other states. But one Portsmouth restaurant continues to welcome candidates and has since the 1960s. NHPR's Emily Corwin brings us the story.
You're not going to just stumble upon Gino's Chowder Shop. It's a solid half mile from downtown near a fishing dock at the end of a tiny street lined with tiny cottages. You have to know how to get there.
Can I have a blue cheese right there?
Please. Inside, the place is the size of a double-wide trailer. Campaign buttons from Ronald Reagan to Gerald Ford and Ross Perot are framed on the wall. Emily Fernald is part of the owner's family. She's bussing plates of chowder to a deck overlooking the river. She's only been old enough to vote for 2 years, she says. But
I have probably met more people running for president than I can remember.
Emily's mom, Francesca Fernald, is making her 34th lobster roll of the day. You were just 3 years old, she tells her daughter.
You sat on Barbara Bush's lap at that table and had fish chowder with her and Governor Judd Gregg's wife.
So you, are you like your daughter? You've spent your entire life here?
Yes, since Barry Goldwater in 1964.
When Francesca's parents bought this place in the 1960s, it was just a barn. 50 years later, Gino's Chowder Shop is one of the state's landmark presidential campaign stops.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well.
When candidates are in town, they defer to the proprietor.
Where should we? Let's check with our owner here.
This is Republican candidate Carly Fiorina. Francesca expects a busy year. The list of candidates from recent elections is long. There's John McCain, Ron Paul, Rudy Giuliani, and Mitt Romney.
It's fun to be part of a presidential campaign, isn't it? This is really something. And
even the regulars here have a political bent. Eating his usual chicken salad sandwich, John Hill says there aren't too many other places in this Democratic-leaning town that feel like home to a Republican. There's Gino's and...
my barber. Who, if he were a Democrat, I wouldn't let touch my head.
So how does a sandwich shop become a political stomping ground? Well, it starts with Francesca's parents, the late Gino Marconi, the place's namesake. He was a lobsterman, his wife Evelyn a homemaker. When they started Gino's, he caught the lobsters and she ran the shop. But Evelyn, who's close to 90 now, had what you might call a proclivity for politics.
I was always very... concerned and very conscientious about what was going on politically because I figured it would affect me one way or another, and it always did.
Evelyn was raised poor by a single dad on Marcy Street, which is next to Prescott Park today, but used to be known as the Red Light District. At 12, Marconi says she was holding posters on election day at the polls. As an adult, she'd track down every local candidate she could to hear personally what they had to say.
And eventually, some of them started to come down here. I thought that was very flattering.
Soon, Marconi was sitting on city council, and she'd become an insatiable networker. Her daughter, Francesca, remembers.
As a kid, that phone in the other room was ringing constantly, and my father bought a 30-foot cord so that she could stand out here and talk on the phone to people and still work at the same time.
It wasn't just the local politicians calling and coming by Geno's. And it wasn't just during the day either. Francesca remembers in the 70s, a younger George Bush Sr., fresh out of the CIA, trying to jumpstart his political career.
We'd close here at 5 o'clock, and then we'd try to have supper, and the bell would ring. And I'd say, oh, Mom, it's that guy again. I said, I'm going upstairs. She goes, he may be president of the United States someday. And I said, I seriously doubt it.
Francesca and Evelyn say they would never think to charge a fee to host a campaign event, nor do they ever wonder how much their signed letters from John F. Kennedy or Richard Nixon would go for. Iconic campaign landmark or not, for them, politics is elemental. It's part of who they are. As 20-year-old Emily Fernald puts it,
the house rule is that you're not allowed to complain about anything if you didn't vote in the election.
And if you spend every day at Geno's Chowder Shop, you probably won't vote until you've eaten a bowl of chowder with every candidate. This year, that's going to be a lot of chowder. For Word of Mouth, I'm Emily Corwin.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks to the former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, hiking the Appalachian Trail is now a euphemism for philandering or making up a zany excuse. That's what his staff said he was doing when he disappeared from contact for 6 days in June of 2009. In reality, Sanford was visiting his mistress, Maria Belen Chapur, in Argentina. It was easy to feel sorry for Jenny Sanford, who was humiliated by her husband's declaration that in Chapur, he'd found his soulmate. Also wounded was Sanford's hard-working and mortified staff, Barton Swaim among them. Swaim worked as a writer for the disgraced governor, who'd once been considered a strong presidential contender. Swaim's book, The Speechwriter, gives us an intimate look at the messy, unpredictable, frequently absurd world of the contemporary political spin room. And Barton Swaim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, soon after coming on board in Governor Mark Sanford's office, you realized you were not hired to write brilliant prose. You had to write loads of letters to constituents, talking points for speeches, and surrogate letters. Now, these are letters to the editor, ostensibly from supporters, but actually written by the governor's staff. Really?
Yes.
I mean, do all politicians do that?
I don't know. I should ask around, but it sounded to me like it was a pretty common thing. It may have had, though, to do with the fact that the governor thought that letters to the editor were important. Now, I don't know if he's wrong about that, because most of us, when we read most letters to the editor, we think it's kind of a poor expression of, unless it's in the Wall Street Journal or something, but if it's in a local paper, you know, they usually seem sort of off balance or angry or something. But he was convinced that any spontaneous expression from an average citizen in print, you know, favorable to him, was a net plus, and it was powerful in its way. And he might be right about that. I don't know. But the trouble is, you couldn't get his supporters to write the letters. You'd call them and you'd say, hey, you know, the governor said such and such. I know you care about that issue. Would you mind writing a letter to the editor? And they'd say, sure. But then they wouldn't do it, or then they wouldn't. You couldn't conjure it up. So somebody along the line had the idea of just writing it for them and you know, emailing it to them. And they'd send it in, which worked a lot of times. And so part of my job occasionally, especially if it was a really contentious issue, was to write, you know, 20 or so of these dreadful things. And it was really hard. It sounds mindless, but it's very engaging in a horrible kind of way, because you had to make them sound like, you know, spontaneous and not what they were, which was calculating attempts to push a certain viewpoint.
So you didn't actually make up names. You sent them to constituents and they signed them.
Yeah, right. I think a lot of people probably do make up names, and editors won't run them. Nowadays, anyway, they'll call you or try to verify that you exist before they run it.
Well, this is one of those glimpses of what goes on inside of the political machine. that I found so illuminating. And of course, there is a very different public persona for the governor than that of his interactions with his staff when nobody was looking. What kind of boss was he?
He was one of those bosses whose leadership style or managerial style is to express extreme dissatisfaction with everything anyone does in the hopes that you'll do it better, which kind of works, actually. You do want to do it better so that it doesn't happen again. And he would not mind, you know, sort of berating you in front of other staffers. It was so bad, though, that it was almost comical in a sort of macabre sort of way. And it happened to everyone. It wasn't personal. You know, it would happen to the chief of staff right on down. And so in a weird sense, it created a kind of camaraderie. And as soon as he walked out of the room, everybody would sort of rate that one. That one was bad, but it wasn't as bad as such and such episode. If you didn't leave crying after the first, you know, couple of months, then you could stick it out.
Well, a lot of people he reduced to tears. He never accepted a document without first saying it was worthless. He was belittling. And there's one extreme show of insensitivity involving a birthday cake for one of your colleagues. What happened there?
Well, if you or I walked past a, you know, in an office setting, walked past someone's birthday cake and it had not been cut, and the candles in it were unlit, we would think, probably shouldn't cut myself a piece. But the governor is a sort of different sort of person. And some people even think this is there's some kind of condition that you could diagnose. I don't know. But he did. It said happy birthday on it, and it was to one of the staffers. And he looked at it and mumbled, "I'll eat this tonight," cut himself a piece, put it on a plate, and walked into his office and shut the door. Now, the crazy thing about that, and this isn't in the book, is that the staffer that happened to,
June, I can't remember.
Yeah, I called her June in the book. She did not remember that. And I think it's because it was that normal to her.
The book reads a little bit like an episode of Veep gone wrong. I mean, the guy is kind of he's always rambling, always demanding, you know, get me something on the X, you know, information. Yep. But you say he wasn't malicious. Well, why do you say not malicious?
He was brutal in getting the thing that he wanted. But as soon as the episode was over, it was as if it never happened. And he wouldn't remember it. You know, later. He's not a vindictive guy. It's just the way he ran the office, and you knew this, and somehow it didn't make it okay, but it made it at least tolerable.
We're getting a glimpse of the inner workings of a modern political office or spin room with Barton Swain. He worked as a speechwriter for the disgraced governor who was once considered a strong presidential contender, Mark Sanford. His new book is called The Speechwriter. Well, Barton, you know, despite the treatment of the staff, they believed he was pretty much incorruptible. And your book almost reads like a, I don't know, a movie or a mystery setup. You know, the person that you least suspect to be behaving badly was behaving badly.
Right.
So what was happening inside of the State House when he went missing for those days in June? He gave the slip to his security detail. Nobody knew where he was.
Yeah, and this often happened. He's the sort of person who likes to go off on his own. And, of course, like anybody else, he would take vacations. And I liked it when he took vacations, which you can see why. And so when media started saying, where's the governor? And we couldn't get a straightforward answer out of, you know, senior staff. It seemed okay to me. I didn't, you know, if the governor of South Carolina is missing, it's not that big of a deal, I didn't think. And so I thought that it was just sort of classic slow news day stuff. Even the day of the press conference that morning, I still thought it was sort of an overblown thing. And, you know, okay, so he went on the Appalachian Trail and couldn't be found. Who cares? He's a weird guy. You know, welcome to my world. Until a deputy chief of staff came in, the person I called June, and she said, the governor is going to say something that will be disappointing. And her eyes were red. So that made my heart sink. And the thing about Sanford to me then was that although I did not like him as a person, I mean, you couldn't like him if you worked for him personally. Although I didn't like him, I did admire him. And I thought that he had a kind of self-control and he behaved like an adult, as I thought, especially as compared to, say, the lieutenant governor and others who were always, you know, up to some crazy shenanigan. He was the last person I would ever have envisioned doing anything like that. I mean, he's not one of those flirty politicians. And when it does happen, you think, well, I could kind of see that. Not at all. In fact, you know, with men and women, when a conversation would turn towards something even vaguely personal, he would immediately change the topic. And so for this to happen was sort of mind-blowing for me and for everybody else. We didn't even know what to think. I mean, it sounds like a cliche probably from a novel or something, but for 2 or 3 days you'd wake up and you think, I had this dumb dream. Oh, wait.
Well, what happened in reality was a reporter working on a tip-off met him at the airport at 5:43 in the morning when he came in from Buenos Aires. Now, you did not write the governor's speech for a hastily called press conference when this whole ruse was discovered. But how about to the staff? How did he apologize to you?
The staff was called together, about 20 of us or so, and the governor was coming, and it was said that he was going to apologize to us. And it seemed in that meeting, which was very weird, it seemed like he wanted to say that he was sorry in some kind of genuine or unqualified way, but it just wouldn't come out. And instead, some very weird things came out about, well, at least, you know, we're not living in a concentration camp, and the sun did actually come up today. And that was it, and it was over.
Well, it's true. You weren't living in a concentration camp.
That's true. That was absolutely true. But as one of my colleagues noted afterwards, while that is true, it probably shouldn't be the governor saying that.
Right. Well, he did. He resigned as a chair of the Republican Governors Association. He survived impeachment hearings, paid back taxpayer money used for the trip. For the staff who'd been badgered and demeaned for so long, was there any, I don't know, sense of like, well, good, he got his comeuppance?
It was a weird dynamic set in psychologically, at least for me, and I think for a few others. After the scandal, a lot of our work necessarily involved protecting a disgraced politician, which is never a thing that you want to do or that you think that you're going to do when you go into a job like this. But strangely, if there was anything that we disliked more than the governor, it was his fiercest enemies in the legislature. Among them, Jakey Knotts, whom I've rendered accurately, though comically, in the book, a kind of vicious buffoon and a racist who's now been defeated and has presumably a job in the private sector. We hated those guys, and they were after him. They knew that they were going to get him thrown out of office. And so in that way, we were able to perform at a higher level than we would have thought possible for this disgraced politician that we couldn't stand anyway.
One of the things I was thinking while reading this book is the whole nature of speech writing. It is theater. You know, the thought of quoting someone else without attribution, you know, that's a hanging offense in politics. Right. But employing someone to make up words that present you as a smarter, more knowledgeable version of yourself is okay. I mean, is speech writing an, I don't know, an honest profession?
Right. I have divided feelings about it. On one hand, it's just impossible for a modern politician who is expected to speak in some way on just scores of things, many of which he doesn't even care about, every day, or, you know, certainly every week, statements to the media, remarks to whatever group wants to say hello in the office, who knows. It's just impossible to say that many things and know or, and have any idea who you're talking to and to have something at least quasi-intelligent to say for each particular audience. And you do need some help, you know, just getting it straight. And for a lot of politicians, I think they don't just get up and parrot the things that they were told to say. They actually think through and edit and so forth. On the other hand, though, I read recently that Warren Harding was the first president to use a speechwriter, and it seems remarkable to me now to think that at one time we had presidents who were not surrounded by a team of communications professionals, and the words that came out of, say, the White House or a governor's office would not be the product of a team of speechwriters and wouldn't have been vetted by all sorts of, you know, communication staffers and policy staffers and so on. It would just be what the president or the governor wanted to say. And so as a result, I think it's hard to even know on at least some topics what the politician in the middle of that circle, what he really thinks about anything.
Barton Swain, thank you for this insider's view. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Barton Swain is a freelance writer who's contributed to the Wall Street Journal, among other places. His book is called The Speechwriter. You can find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. And when we return, the complicated relationship between the first American woman to run for president and the nation she sought to lead. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Victoria Woodhull's 1872 campaign for president came at a time when American women did not even have the right to vote. Not that they would have backed her if they did. Radio Diaries' Joe Richman and Samara Freemark bring us the story of America's first female presidential hopeful.
My name is Scott Claflin, and I am a descendant of Victoria Claflin Woodhull. The first time I began to become aware of my relative was in 1964, when the Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith was running for President of the United States.
Senator Smith posing now for the photographers, wearing her traditional robes, looking very happy and very pleased about the whole thing.
They were talking about history being made, with Margaret Chase Smith being the first woman to run for president. We're watching, and my dad said, "That's not right. These guys don't know what they're talking about."
My name is Amanda Friskin, and I wrote the book Victoria Woodhull's Sexual Revolution. Woodhull came from an unusual family, the Claflins. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, but they moved a lot, kind of traveling salesman, catch-as-catch-can. And at the age of 14, Woodhull was married off by her parents to a man who proved to be an alcoholic, and she had a pretty hard life with him. She was traveling around when she said she had a revelation to go out there and declare her right to be a woman in public and to be a powerful woman. And so she packed up and came to New York.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
She started a radical newspaper. She opened the first woman's stock brokerage firm. But the thing that gave her national fame was when she sent a card to the New York Herald declaring her candidacy for the presidency.
Letter to the New York Herald, April 2nd, 1871. I claim the right to speak for the unenfranchised woman of the country and announce myself as a candidate for the presidency.
For a woman at that moment to be running for president, when most women in the country couldn't even cast a ballot, made this a pretty extreme act.
If the men should see the women going to the polls.
In the 19th century, lots of women were making claims about women's rights. You might think that women suffragists turned to Woodhull, and some of them did. But the suffragists in the 1870s tended to be middle class to upper middle class women, more conventional, more serious. Woodhull was really an outsider, not well educated, rather uncouth. And some of them just thought she was insane.
Though all the men should frown on us when going to the polls.
The thing that really made Woodhull notorious was when she gave a speech in New York City on November 20th, 1871, entitled The Principles of Social Freedom. In that speech, she claimed marriage was a form of tyranny for women.
It is high time that your sisters and daughters should no longer be led to the altar like sheep to the shambles. The sexual relation must be rescued from this insidious form of slavery. I protest.
She was speaking, and a woman yelled out and said, "Do you believe in free love?" And she said, "Yes, I believe in free love."
Yes, I am a free lover. I have an inalienable, constitutional, and natural right to love whom I may, to change that love every day if I please, and neither you nor any law you can frame have any right to interfere.
She was really just making a rhetorical point in the middle of a much more complicated speech. But that's the one that everyone put in the paper. It became known as her free love speech. And it gave her instant national fame, but not necessarily the kind that she had hoped for.
1872, she was nominated by the Equal Rights Party at a convention in New York City.
It was very easy for the press to lampoon this. They thought it was ridiculous.
About 800 members of the Woodhull Wing assembled yesterday morning at Apollo Hall. The exercises were opened by the singing of Hail Columbia, after which a frivolous and tedious discussion on irrelevant topics arose.
The Equal Rights Party advocated women's rights to fair wages in the workplace, shorter work days, and they also advocated civil rights for freedmen and women. And when the discussion over the vice presidency came up, they nominated probably the most well-known African-American man at the time, Frederick Douglass. But they didn't ask him first, and he never accepted the nomination. He felt that it was probably wiser not to dignify the nomination with a response. The convention was really the high point for Woodhull, and after that, things really went downhill for her. As a result of the notoriety of the nomination, Woodhull was evicted from her home, and she had some trouble making ends meet. She then lashed out at a former ally, Henry Ward Beecher, who was a very prominent minister, saying that he wouldn't support the free love cause, he wouldn't support social freedom publicly, that he was a coward for not doing that because everyone knows Beecher is privately practicing free love, that he had dozens of mistresses. And she then decided to publish the story. That didn't help her situation, it made it a lot worse.
She was arrested for sending obscenities through the mail under laws that no longer exist, the Comstock laws. And on election day, she sat in jail.
Woodhull wasn't on the ballot anywhere on the election of 1872. So in terms of actual voting numbers, we have no record that anyone voted for Woodhull. She was a woman who has a terrible reputation, who may have at least temporarily done the cause more harm than good, but she's the first woman to put her name out there and say, "I want to run for president." It makes for a very complicated founding narrative for women. You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women. And you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first. I mean, she's the one we have to live with.
And that piece was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries as part of the Contenders series. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd also like to hear from you. What are your most memorable experiences from primary season, be it this one or seasons past? You can do that at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And if you missed any of today's show, catch it in its entirety at the Word of Mouth podcast. You can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please join our campaign and tell a friend. As we know, opinions still count when passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.